From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The average death rate in the city during normal times is between 360 to 380 people a day. Today, we have around 700.
Record heat in Russia doubles the death rate in Moscow to hundreds a day. Wildfires in Russia, floods in Pakistan and China, drought in Niger. We'll speak with meteorologist Jeff Masters. Are the world's diplomats any closer to a binding agreement on climate change? We'll talk to Bolivia's ambassador to the United Nations, Pablo Solon. He's just back from a round of negotiations in Bonn. Then to Latin America.
The word war is not in my vocabulary. When I think of Colombia's relations with its neighbors or any other country on the planet.
Colombia's new president, Juan Manuel Santos, is meeting with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez today. Is this a new beginning on the continent? We'll speak with Latin American historian Greg Grandin about this and other developments in Latin America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations says the number of people suffering from the massive floods in Pakistan has now exceeded 13 million, more than the combined total of people affected by the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, the 2005 Kashmir earthquake, and the 2010 Haiti earthquake combined, though the death toll in Pakistan is far lower. The UN says just under 300,000 homes have been destroyed or damaged, almost the same as those destroyed in Haiti. At least 1,600 people have died in Pakistan. 2 million have been left homeless. The Islamic Relief Charity says the floods have destroyed the entire infrastructure of parts of Pakistan. Michael O'Brien works for the International Committee of the Red Cross in Pakistan.
I would say that early on, the scope of this disaster might have been a little underestimated. It's really quite catastrophic in its proportions, and it's going to have a long-term impact. But in terms of the international community, I think they're probably aware of the problem now. The issue is no country would have coped easily with the extent of the damage that's been caused here. It's just enormous.
In technology news, Google and Verizon have issued a proposal that could radically restructure the internet by essentially creating a two-tiered internet system. At first glance, the Google and Verizon proposal appears to promote the idea of net neutrality, that users should have equal access to all types of information online. But the Google and Verizon proposal includes a massive loophole that would exempt from net neutrality protections all internet access over cell phone and wireless networks and any future new subscriptions services that broadband providers could provide. Jason Rosenbaum is with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee.
The Google and Verizon deal announced today is the first step towards corporate control over the internet. They propose creating two tiers of internet service, a public version of the internet that everybody will be able to use without fear of discrimination, and then a private version that the big corporations will control absolutely. And that's the version that they're likely going to put all of their investment in. So when it comes down to it, people in America will have a choice. They'll be able to use the corporate-controlled internet, where they'll get their information from corporate sources very quickly, or they'll be able to use the quote-unquote public internet, and that's going to be relegated to the slow lane.
Craig Aaron of the group Free Press says the Google plan could permanently shift who controls the internet.
The beauty of the internet is that you're able to get online, go wherever you want, do whatever you want, download whatever you want. And if you're a content creator, then you have the opportunity to have the reach of a television station or a radio station or a cable channel. All you have to have is that good idea or something interesting to say. But if you change the way the internet works, if you reserve that fast lane just for a few select companies, that opportunity goes away.
Jason Rosenbaum of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee says he also has concerns about the impact of the Google-Verizon proposal on free speech online.
Already seen how corporate control over networks can lead to political discrimination. So there was a text message sent out by NARAL Pro-Choice that was blocked by wireless carriers because the wireless carriers disagreed with the message. When you have internet activities or you know various online activities running on a corporate-controlled network, you're opening the door to this kinds of censorship. It's very much a free speech issue, very much a civil rights issue.
In military news, Defense Secretary Robert Gates has outlined a plan to slightly reduce the Pentagon's record $500 billion annual budget. Gates is proposing to reduce spending on private contractors, to close the Joint Forces Command in Norfolk, Virginia, and eliminate 50 generals and admirals and 150 top civilian posts over 2 years. The closure of the Joint Forces Command would result in thousands of job losses. Gates did not say how much money the budget cuts will save, but it will be only a small fraction of the Pentagon's overall budget, which has doubled since 2001. Even with the proposed cuts, the Pentagon's budget's expected to rise again next year by just under 2% to $549 billion, not including the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The United Nations is reporting civilian casualties have risen by 31% in the first half of 2010, a much sharper rise than the recent estimate by an independent Afghan human rights body. The UN report blamed the Taliban and other militant groups for three-quarters of the killings. The number of children killed or injured over the past 6 months has jumped by 55%. Staffan de Mistura of the United Nations said, quote, "Afghan children and women are increasingly bearing the brunt of the conflict." Meanwhile, the UN said the U.S. and NATO killed 223 civilians in the first 6 months, a lower tally than in the first 6 months of last year. Released the names of its medical aid workers who were killed in Afghanistan last week in an ambush. The attack against the Christian charity has been described as the worst crime targeting the humanitarian community that has ever taken place in Afghanistan. The dead included optometrist Dr. Tom Little, 61, of Delmar, New York, 32-year-old Cheryl Beckett of Owensville, Ohio, Dan Terry, 63, of Janesville, Wisconsin, 40-year-old Glenn Lapp of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 25-year-old freelance videographer Brian Cardarelli of Harrisonburg, Pennsylvania, and the 51-year-old dentist Thomas Grams of Durango, Colorado. The dead also included two Afghans named Mahram Ali and Jawad, Daniela Bayer of Germany, and Dr. Karen Wu of Britain. The International Assistance Mission has worked in Afghanistan since 1966. Up until last week, the group had lost just four international staff members. In other Afghan news, General David Petraeus is preparing to launch a public relations campaign to build up support for the war effort. He's scheduled to do a series of high-profile interviews in the coming weeks, beginning with Meet the Press on Sunday. In news from Guantanamo, a U.S. military judge has ruled that Canadian prisoner Omar Khadr's confessions to interrogators can be used as evidence against him in his trial, even though Khadr's lawyers say the statements were illegally obtained through torture and cruelty. Khadr's attorney, Dennis Edney, criticized the judge's decision.
Well, my reaction is that Judge Parrish should go back to school and learn some of the basic principles of law. I guess what he says is it's okay for a young 15-year-old boy who's picked up off the battlefield in an environment that's hostile, and it's okay to threaten him with rape and sexual abuse.
Omar Khadr's trial on charges including murder and terrorism conspiracy is due to start today. Khadr is a 23-year-old Canadian citizen who's already spent a third of his life in the Guantanamo prison camp. His trial will be the first war crimes tribunal anywhere since World War II to prosecute someone for acts allegedly committed as a juvenile. He was captured in Afghanistan at the age of 15. In an attempt to combat the increasing violence resulting from drug trafficking, former Mexican President Vicente Fox has come out in favor of legalizing drugs in both Mexico and the United States. Fox described legalization as a strategy to strike and break the economic structure that allows the mafias to generate huge profits in their business. Fox went on to say, quote, "What is happening is that this huge market of the United States in drug consumption, the largest in the world, is generating the weapons that are sold to Mexican cartels and is generating the money that is laundered in the United States and brought to Mexico." It's estimated 28,000 people have been killed in the drug war in Mexico since 2006. In news from the Gulf of Mexico, an increasing number of oiled wildlife are being discovered despite recent assertions by BP that just a quarter of the leaked oil remains in the Gulf. The Times-Picayune reports almost double the daily average of oiled birds are now being collected, while more oiled turtles have been discovered in the last 10 days than during the spill's first 3 months. Meanwhile, local news sources in the Gulf are reporting recent discoveries by fishermen of crabs with black gills. One fisherman stated, "I've never seen anything like this. There's oil on the bottom out there. The crab is a bottom feeder." Scientists are also reporting never-seen-before mixtures of dispersant and crude oil inside tiny blue crab collected in Gulf waters. In Lebanon, the investigation into the 2005 killing of the former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri has taken on a new turn. On Monday, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah claimed Israel was behind the killing, showing intercepted Israeli surveillance footage from an unmanned aerial vehicle of Hariri's travel routes. Israeli officials dismissed Nasrallah's claims. Many analysts have predicted the International Tribunal investigating the 2005 assassination would hold Hezbollah culpable. Israel's threatened to pull out of a UN inquiry into the deadly raid on a Turkish flotilla heading for Gaza if the UN tries to question soldiers who took part in the operation. An aide to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said, quote, "Israel will not cooperate with or take part in any panel that seeks to interrogate Israeli soldiers." At the war crimes trial of former Liberian President Charles Taylor, actress Mia Farrow told a court hearing Monday that she'd heard supermodel Naomi Campbell say she'd been given a huge diamond by Taylor when he was Liberia's president. Prosecutors are hoping Farrow's claim will help establish that Taylor was involved in the trade of so-called blood diamonds illegally mined from Sierra Leone. Last week, Naomi Campbell appeared before the court in The Hague and admitted she'd received diamonds after a 1997 charity dinner in South Africa with Nelson Mandela, but did not know if they were from Taylor. On Monday, Farrow contradicted Campbell and described meeting with Campbell the morning after she received the diamonds.
"From Miss Campbell. Miss Campbell entered the room. My children and I were already eating breakfast. And as I recall it, she was quite excited and said, in effect, oh, my God, in the middle of the night last night, or last night, I was awakened by knocking at the door, and it was men sent by Charles Taylor, and he sent me, as I recall, a huge diamond."
And in news from Capitol Hill, the House Ethics Committee issued a report Monday accusing Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California of three ethics violations. The Los Angeles Times reports she's accused of violating three rules. One that requires its members to, quote, "behave at all times in a manner that shall reflect creditably on the House." A second that prohibits lawmakers from using their influence for personal benefit. And a third for forbidding the dispensing of favors. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Wildfires across Russia. Devastating floods in Pakistan, deadly landslides and flash floods in India and China, heat waves across the United States, severe drought in Niger. Taken together, scientists warn they could match predictions for extreme climate events caused by global warming. This year is on track to be the warmest since reliable temperature records began over a century ago, mainly due to a buildup of greenhouse gases from fossil fuels. That's according to the UN World Meteorological Organization. In Moscow, the heat has doubled the daily death rate. This is Andrei Seltsovsky, the head of Moscow's health department.
"The average death rate in the city during normal times is between 360 to 380 people a day. Today, we have around 700. This is no secret. Everyone thinks we are trying to keep it secret. Look, it is 40 degrees Celsius on the street."
Over 1,600 have been killed by the floods in Pakistan, and landslides have killed over 300 in China. The estimated damage to homes, infrastructure, and crops caused by the wildfires and the floods amounts to billions of dollars. And in Russia, among the world's largest exporters of wheat, all future grain exports have been banned for the rest of the year. Well, we begin today with an overview of the extreme weather events in countries around the world. Dr. Jeff Masters is co-founder and director of meteorology for Weather Underground, a weather information website. His latest post is about the heat wave in Russia, joining us now from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome to Democracy Now! Dr. Masters, talk about, first, what is happening in Russia.
Well, in Russia, they're getting a heat wave unlike anything that's ever been recorded in that country. Certainly going back the last 130 years when we have good records, and then probably going back as much as 1,000 years if you look at the historical records. There's never been heat like this in Moscow and over this huge area of Russia. To give you some idea of what we're talking about, back in 1920, Russia recorded its highest temperature in Moscow on record, 99 degrees Fahrenheit. That record has been broken 5 times just in the past 2 weeks. So this is unprecedented heat, not only for Moscow, but for a huge region of Russia and some neighboring countries as well.
And talk about the effects in Russia, from wildfires to what we're seeing, what, more than 300 more deaths in Moscow alone a day as a result of the heat that also leads to terrible problems of pollution.
Yeah, the combined effects of heat and then air pollution and then smoke from fires is a terrible killer. We saw in 2003, when we had a similar heat wave over France and most of Europe, the death toll reached over 40,000. And I think in Russia, we're going to be seeing death tolls certainly in the tens of thousands from this heat wave as well. The smoke in particular is causing a tremendous hardship on the people and the elderly in particular in Russia.
Talk about the rest of the world, Dr. Masters.
Okay, well, the entire world, if you look at the past 6 months, has experienced its warmest year on record, going back to the late 1800s when we first started making measurements. And so it's not a surprise that we might be seeing record heat waves and record high temperatures being set. In fact, there are 17 countries in the world that have set their extreme all-time heat record this year. And that's the most we've ever seen. The previous time was back in 2007, when 15 countries set their all-time heat record. And those heat records this year include a 128-degree Fahrenheit reading in Pakistan, which is the highest temperature ever reliably recorded in the entire continent of Asia. So there's been heat all over the globe. The ocean temperatures have been at record warm levels this year, and including in the tropical Atlantic, where we're expecting a severe hurricane season. So it's heat, heat, heat is the name of the game this year on planet Earth.
July 2010 was the sixth straight record warm month in the tropical Atlantic and had the third warmest anomaly of any month in history. What does that mean?
Well, when you get those kind of sea surface temperatures, it provides extra energy for hurricanes, which is what we're most worried about, because hurricanes are heat engines. They suck heat out of the ocean, and they convert that heat to the energy of their winds. So we're expecting at least double the usual number of intense hurricanes this year, the ones that are most likely to do high levels of damage. And the other thing all that heat does, if it's down in the Caribbean, where a lot of it is it causes coral mortality. You get bleaching episodes where you'll kill a large amount of coral. And back in 2005, the last year we had temperatures this warm in the tropical Atlantic, we had a massive die-off of coral, particularly in the Virgin Islands and some of the neighboring islands.
Jeff Masters, talk about the United States.
Well, in the U.S., we've had some heat waves here as well, particularly in the South. We've had some daily records set. And as a rule, though, we haven't gotten the extreme heat that has been seen in other parts of the world, back in over in Asia and Africa and Europe. So the U.S. has kind of lucked out this year. I mean, it's been hot, but we haven't had a severe drought or extreme heat waves like have been experienced in other parts of the world. Certainly, if we would have had the kind of weather that Russia's experiencing, it would have been an all-time record heat wave for this country and probably been the worst natural disaster in American history.
The Asian Southwest monsoon, exceptionally deadly this year. What countries, what areas, regions of the earth did it affect?
Well, primarily Pakistan, where they had the worst flooding in that country's history. But also neighboring areas of India along Kashmir, and then China, where over 700 people are dead today in a landslide that was triggered by heavy monsoon rains. Afghanistan as well has seen heavy monsoon rains. So it's been an exceptional year for the monsoon, And I think part of that is due to the fact that the temperatures have been so warm in that area. I mean, we've seen record heat in Asia this year. And when you have a very warm atmosphere, you can evaporate more water vapor into it, which potentially can cause more flooding. And in fact, if you look at the past few decades, the amount of heavy precipitation events in the Indian monsoon has increased substantially. We've seen almost a doubling in some of these very heavy rainfall events. Although the total amount of water falling down has not changed much, it's these extreme events that have increased. And that's in line with what climate prediction models are showing will continue to happen this century as the climate warms.
The ice island that broke off of Greenland, that's four times the size of Manhattan. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Well, that particular ice island broke off the northern coast of Greenland, where we haven't really seen this kind of effect before. And what's going on is that the temperatures in Greenland over the past decade have been very, very warm. And particularly over North Greenland this year, we've seen some very warm temperatures that have caused substantial melting of some of these glaciers and made them more vulnerable to large icebergs calving off of them. So it's just kind of a continuation of the warm pattern we've seen up there in the Arctic over the past few decades.
What is the connection between all of this extreme weather and climate change, global warming, Jeff Masters?
Well, what we're seeing this year is a preview of things to come. As the Earth continues to warm, we're going to see more extreme precipitation events. We're going to see more heat waves. And this year is kind of a foretaste of that. Now, not every year is going to be like this. For instance, if you look at last year, it was a relatively quiet year as far as natural disasters go. The amount of dollars paid by the insurance companies was below average. But we're going to start seeing more and more years like this year when you get these amazing events that cause tremendous death and destruction. And the concern I have is that as this extreme weather continues to increase in coming decades and the population increases, the ability of the international community to respond to these disasters and provide aid to victims is going to be stretched to the limit. And we're not going to be able to respond. And we're going to get in a situation where there's going to be global emergencies that continue year after year all across the countries. And we're just going to be struggling to cope with that.
Finally, Jeff Masters, explain what Weather Underground is and what you feel about, I mean, there is tremendous amount of weather reported in the corporate media, in the mainstream media all the time. People tune in constantly for it. It's more and more frequent because it affects people's lives. And yet, you rarely hear the words global warming put together with extreme weather. So there's no sense anyone can do anything about it.
Well, you can put those words together with extreme weather. You have to talk a little bit carefully about it because no single event can be blamed on climate change or global warming. But what I like to say sometimes is that we load the dice in favor of more extreme events. And perhaps it's a better analogy to say we're putting more spots on the dice. It used to be when you roll the dice, you'd get snake eyes or you'd get double sixes. But I think now, particularly when we're talking about extreme temperature events, there's more spots on the dice. You can't roll snake eyes anymore, but you can roll a 13. And that's what happened to Russia this year. They rolled a 13. I don't think that kind of event was possible until recent decades because global warming increased the baseline temperature of the world. So I talk all the time about global warming and say, you know, we have to be cognizant of the fact that global warming is making heavy precipitation events and extreme heat waves more likely. Can't say this particular heat wave is to blame for it, but boy, it sure is going to be more and more the case as the decades go on. We'll see these type of events.
Would you call on your fellow weathermen and women? I mean, there are conferences, I presume, that you go to where all of you are talking, to start making this link in the mainstream media when they do their news reports.
Well, I do talk to some of these people, but most of them don't go to the scientific conferences. They tend to stay in their TV studios and look at their own data. I think there's a disconnect between the research community and TV meteorologists. And a lot of TV meteorologists are very skeptical that human-caused global climate change is real. They've been seduced by the view pushed by the fossil fuel industry that humans really aren't responsible. And you can come up with all kinds of excuses. I'm sure you've heard them all, that, you know, climate scientists are doing it for, you know, to get attention and research money, that the temperature record's flawed because, you know, we've got the heat island effect in cities and so on. But all of that is just propaganda that's been put out by the PR industry of the fossil fuel industry. And it's convinced a lot of TV meteorologists that that's the case. So it's a tough road here because we're fighting a battle against an enemy that's very well funded, that's intent on providing disinformation about what the real science says. So I do my best, but it's a tough uphill battle.
Who's the enemy?
Well, it's the PR industry in favor of the fossil fuel interests, trying to convince us that global climate change is not real.
Dr. Jeff Masters, I want to thank you very much for being with us, co-founder and director of meteorology for Weather Underground, an internet weather information service. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we're joined by Pablo Salón. He's Bolivia's ambassador to the United Nations, just back from climate talk negotiations in Bonn. Stay with us. Music of Bolivia here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Even as the world faces a series of extreme weather events that scientists warn is related to global warming, international climate negotiations are moving at a glacial pace. The latest round of climate talks in Bonn, Germany, ended last week, and diplomats have just one more short meeting in China in the coming months to hash out their differences before the critical high-level climate conference in Cancun, Mexico, at the end of the year. At the meetings in Bonn, the negotiating text got a lot bigger, and a number of proposals from developing countries were added into the controversial agreement that came out of the divisive Copenhagen summit last year. Some fear the new text could slow down talks in Cancun, but others say the concerns of the majority of the world's countries are finally represented in the text. For more on what this means for a binding global agreement on climate change, I'm joined here in New York by Ambassador Pablo Salón, Bolivia's permanent representative to the United Nations. He was just in Bonn last week. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello. Pleasure to be here with you.
It's good to have you with us. As you listen to the litany of extreme weather all over the world, your thoughts as you return from Bonn?
Well, I would say that what you have shown is a reality that is not changing as fast as we would want, the process of negotiation. I have heard speeches in Bonn relating the situation in Pakistan, but the concrete pledges to reduce greenhouse gas emissions are the same that 1 year ago. And with the current pledges of emission reductions from developed countries, we are going to be in something like 3 to 4 degrees Celsius, an increase in 3 to 4 degrees Celsius. Now, what we are seeing, what you have shown, is related to an increase of less than 1 degree Celsius. So, can you imagine a situation where this triples or multiplies by 4? It's unbelievable. And still, developed countries have put on the table targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that will increase the temperature dramatically during the coming years and during this century. So that is something that until now it hasn't changed. I go negotiation to all the negotiations during this year. We have put all the evidence, and still the pledges of developed countries remain the same, very, very low, almost do business as usual.
What about the United States in particular? Where are we on this?
The United States has made a very, very small pledge. It is something that means to reduce 3% from the levels of 1990. To compare it, other countries like the European Union have said that 20% to 30%. The United States, 3%, so almost nothing at all. Why? That is the question. Because corporate interests, economy, profits have more weight in the negotiation than, I would say, to preserve life and biodiversity and Mother Earth in climate talks. So that is the problem that we are facing. In Cancun, the greatest challenge is, are we going to have a deal where developed countries are going to reduce in the next 7 years at least the half of their emissions? Yes or no? We say it very clearly. If this doesn't happen, what we are seeing now is just the first episode of a tragedy. So we need to put a lot of pressure around the whole world if we want really to have a greenhouse gas emission reduction that saves life.
Just remind people, how would you summarize what happened in Copenhagen, just to get a sense of where we are now?
Well, what happened in Copenhagen was that the process of negotiation was kidnapped by a group of countries. Usually we negotiate 192 countries. And suddenly in Copenhagen, a group of countries said, now, this is the Copenhagen Accord. It's 3 a.m. in the morning. You have 1 hour to sign it. And of course we said, no, not at all. We want to discuss it. Why? Because in that Copenhagen Accord said that the target was to limit the temperature to 2 degrees Celsius. So that is almost three times what we are seeing now. And there are a lot of countries that are saying we should limit the temperature to 1.5 or to 1 degree Celsius. That is the proposal of Bolivia. Why? Because some states are going to disappear. There is a state called Tuvalu. Its wide is 607 meters. Its highest hill is 4 meters. If the temperature keeps rising, it will be under the water. So now we have, after the climate talk in Bonn, a new text. It's bigger, as you have said. But it has the proposals of developing countries to limit the increase of the temperature, to develop a climate court of justice, because somebody has to be responsible for this, to not only commodify, to not make profit through a new market, carbon market mechanism, but also to recognize the rights of Mother Earth in the process of negotiation. So now we have a text that reflects, from our point of view, the proposals that were made in Cochabamba, in the People's World Conference on Climate Change and Mother Earth Rights. So now the key thing is, from here until Cancun, what is going to prevail? It's going to prevail the people's voice, Mother Earth's voice, or is going to prevail corporate's voice?
I'm looking at a piece by John Vidal in The Guardian. New research reveals carbon emissions from rich nations could actually rise under loopholes in the proposed UN climate deal. What are these gaping loopholes in the climate change treaty put forward in Copenhagen?
Well, it's, for example, a country says, I'm going to reduce 20%. So you say, oh, that's fantastic. But in reality, there is some tricky parts in the different treaties that allow him, for example, to buy certificates of emission reduction in another developing country. So he, in reality, is not going to reduce. He's just going to pay somebody else that is going to do his job, but there won't be a real emission reduction. Second, there is a way of accounting. So I say, I'm reducing because now I have planted some more trees here and I account them in this way. So there are too many things in the negotiation that really make things even worse. So today in Bonn, or last week in Bonn, it was very clear that they say the average is going to be a reduction in the best scenario of 18%, taking into account the levels of 1990. But because of these loopholes, in reality, there could be an increase to 4 to 7 or 7% of the emissions of 1990. So what we are asking for is that when a country says, I'm going to reduce, say it very clearly. How much are you going to reduce domestically without any kind of loopholes, without any kind of carbon market, without any kind of offsets? That is the only way to have a clear negotiation that is transparent for people.
Has the U.S. attitude changed at all? I mean, after Copenhagen, you spoke out fiercely against it. President Morales did as well. The United States penalized you by millions of dollars, saying if you wouldn't sign on to the Copenhagen Accord. Is that right?
Yeah.
Did you sign on?
No, of course not. I mean, they penalized us with an aid of $3 million because they said we didn't support the Copenhagen Accord, and we said you can keep your money, but we are not fighting for a couple of coins. We're fighting for life.
Why? How does this affect Bolivia?
Well, we have glaciers, for example, in Bolivia. Until now, we have lost one-third of our glaciers. If this situation continues in Bolivia, we're going to lose the vast majority of our glaciers. All our mountains will be naked. And you know the consequences for that in relation to water, for agriculture, for drinking water for the populations there. And this is a situation where we cannot hide ourselves. We think that there has to be a very responsible action. And coming to the first part of your question, I would say that the situation in the United States has begun to move backwards. What I feel is that when this proposal of law was withdrawn from the Senate, then everybody began to say, oh.
In the energy bill.
Yeah. Then the United States is not even going to go move forward, move beyond what they have already said they were going to do, but instead they can move backwards. That is the perception that I feel in from other developed countries. So if the United States is not going to do too much, then the others say, why should I do it? And then comes a discussion of, well, if I do more and the United States does so less, then I will be in a difficult situation to compete with the products of the United States because I will have to invest more in clean energy. And so at the end, what happens is we're in a very difficult situation.
It's interesting. I remember when Bolivia held the climate change conference. The foreign minister of Ecuador said, in response to Ecuador also being penalized millions for not signing on to the Copenhagen Accord, the U.S. cutting off money to Ecuador, they said they would give that money to the United States, an equivalent amount of money, I think it was like $2 million, if the U.S. would sign on to the Kyoto Treaty. But I wanted to go back to a few weeks ago, we had Maude Barlow on, the former water representative at the United Nations. The day that the resolution was passed that you, Ambassador Pablo Solon of Bolivia, had put forward around the issue of water and sanitation. This is an excerpt of what you had to say at the U.N.
At the global level, approximately one out of every eight people do not have drinking water. In just one day, more than 200 million hours of the time used by women is spent collecting and transporting water for their homes. The lack of sanitation is even worse because it affects 2.6 billion people, which represents 40% of the global population. According to the report of the World Health Organization and of UNICEF of 2009, which is titled Diarrhea, Why Children Are Dying and What We Can Do, every day, 24,000 children die in developing countries due to causes that can be prevented, such as diarrhea, which is caused by contaminated water. This means that a child dies every 3.5 seconds. 1, 2, 3. As they say in my village, the time is now.
Bolivia's ambassador to the United Nations, Pablo Solon, he's our guest today in studio. The first resolution on this issue, explain.
Well, in the UN, we have recognized the right to food, the human right to education, the right to work, the right to social security. But for 60 years, we haven't recognized the human right to water. So it's the first time in history that the UN recognizes the human right to water and sanitation.
Who supported it and who didn't?
We had 42 countries that co-sponsored the resolution, that they, 122 countries voted in favor, and 42 countries abstained.
Abstained.
So that means that 75% of the countries that were present voted in favor and 25% abstained. Nobody voted against, but many made speeches expressing that they didn't support the resolution, but that they were not going to vote against.
And the U.S. being one of the abstainers?
Yes, the U.S. was one of them.
Why? What would it bind them to? What are the forces that say no to a people's right to water?
I always have asked that question. For me, it's something that I can't understand, because you cannot put in first place privatization or corporate interests or transboundary issues related to water in front of the necessity of recognizing the human right to water. But I would say that behind these abstentions, there were this kind of concerns. But the vast majority was so strong that they couldn't say, no, we're going to vote against. They just had to abstain. And that was, at the end, very important, because if a resolution passed without any vote against, in reality, the resolution has been approved by consensus under the UN rules.
So what is different from here on in, now that this resolution on the human right to water, and also add why sanitation?
And sanitation.
What is the significance of
sanitation? Well, now we're going to see the difference when the summit on the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals, come in September, because there's going to be a review of, and we're going to discuss what we are going to do in order to accomplish these goals until 2015. And we have a very critical situation in relation to water. One of eight citizens in the world doesn't have clean water. But the situation is even worse when it comes to sanitation, because 40% of the worldwide population doesn't have sanitation. And different presidents and governments are going to be here in New York. And the main discussion is, now we have recognized it, how much are we going to put on the table in relation to money, to efforts, to transfer of technology, in order really to make a change in this? Why do we highlight very, very much the issue of water? Because climate change is going to affect in a very severe way the access to water. For Africa, it will mean a strong desertification. So it's necessary to take all the measures now, or we're going to see a situation even worse than what we are seeing now.
We're talking to Ambassador Pablo Salón about the right to, the human right to water and sanitation. At the same time in Bolivia, there is a conflict going on. I wanted to ask you about that, Ambassador. A coalition of some 6,000 people in the southern Bolivian mining area of Potosí have blocked off the area for over 10 days, cut all rail links to Chile, and launched a hunger strike. On Friday, they shut down the city's airfield, and some 100 tourists were stranded in the area. The demonstrators are calling for more investment by the Bolivian government in the lithium-rich area.
Hasta mañana. Lo que estamos pidiendo y con las notas estamos anticipando, entonces estaríamos.
If they fail to heed what we have asked for in the documents by tomorrow, we are going to blow up the high tension lines that supply electricity to the San Cristobal mine. So production is stopped in the mines in southeast Potosí, like San Vicente and Chorloqui.
Can you respond to what he just said?
Well, yes, but the reason of the conflict that now is in Potosí is a conflict between borders, between two of the states, two of the provinces inside Bolivia. It is really something that the government is trying to solve, because there's a conflict between the limits of one of the province and the other province. In relation to the other issue that it has to do with the interview, the issue of lithium, it's the first time that we want to develop and to industrialize our lithium, but for our country, not to be exploited and exported as raw material to other places, and so we just see almost no added value being developed inside Bolivia. So the main task that we have is how we develop an industry related to lithium inside our country, because the history of Bolivia and the history of Potosí, where those protests are taking place, was a city that 400 years ago was bigger than London. But why you have it like that? Because even though it had a mountain that was full of silver, all of that silver went to Europe and nothing remained in the country. Now we have the opportunity to change the situation
of
Bolivia.
Meaning you not only want to make the lithium, you want to make the electric cars, yeah, you want to make the batteries. Lithium batteries, you want to make the drug? What, it's also the drug, lithium, right?
Yes, all the products related that what one can produce from lithium. That is our challenge. The history of Bolivia and of, I would say, many of the developing countries is that for centuries we have only being suppliers of raw materials.
This report that came out, that's, I mean, you have been called the Saudi Arabia of lithium.
Yeah.
But now this report has come out that says Afghanistan, you have more than half the world supply. That and Afghanistan may surpass Bolivia. Is this true?
I don't know, because those reports, we don't have concrete evidence. But if another country has that, it's very good. I mean, why should we always think I must be the only country that have this? I have to be the only country that can make profit out of something. I mean, if you have a natural resource that is very important, think how you are going to use it responsible, not think how you're going to benefit for your own profit. That is what we think we should change, really, because that is the way things have been moved until now, and that is why we are in this dramatic situation. That is why we're promoting a new kind of relation with our natural resources. They are not natural resources. We call them, they are our Mother Earth. We should try to look and seek balance with the whole system and not try to think, oh, I have lithium, oh, I have gold, or I have water. How am I going to exploit it? How am I going to make profit out of it? The question is, how am I going to live in harmony with nature?
Ambassador Salón, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Bolivia's ambassador to the United Nations, Pablo Salón. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see our week's coverage from Cochabamba when Bolivia led the People's Conference on Climate Change and the Rights of Mother Earth, Pachamama, in the indigenous language. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we look at developments in Latin America. Stay with us. late Lassa de Sela. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. Colombia and Venezuela are expected to reestablish trade and diplomatic ties after their leaders meet today to defuse a simmering crisis. Colombia's new president, Juan Manuel Santos, who was inaugurated Saturday, will meet with the Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, in Santa Marta, Colombia, the site where South American liberation hero Simón Bolívar died in 1830. In his inaugural address, Santos, who was defense minister under former President Álvaro Uribe, called for frank and direct dialogue with Chavez.
La palabra guerra no está en mi diccionario.
The word war is not in my vocabulary. When I think of Colombia's relations with its neighbors or any other country on the planet,
quien diga que quiere la guerra.
It's easy to say that he who says he wants war has not had the responsibility of sending soldiers to a real war. I have had that responsibility. I have sent soldiers, seamen, and police officers to fight terrorism. I have consoled their widows and orphans, and I know how painful it is.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez responded by calling for Colombian guerrillas to free all their hostages and give up their armed conflict. Last month, Chavez cut all ties with Colombia over accusations from the former Colombian government of Álvaro Uribe that some 1,500 guerrillas were operating in Venezuela. To talk more about this, I'm joined here in New York by Latin American historian Greg Grandin, professor of history at New York University, author of Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States, and the Rise of the New Imperialism. His most recent book, Fordlandia, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in History. Welcome to Democracy Now! And congratulations on being a finalist. Greg, the significance of the former defense minister of Uribe, now president of Colombia, Santos, saying he wanted to improve relations with, well, Venezuela, also Ecuador.
Yeah, well, I think that he's caught between a rock and a hard place, between pressures from within Colombia that have mitigated against establishing good relations with Venezuela. I mean, if we step back and we look at the beginning of this conflict back in 2007, 2008, Chavez actually had good relationships with Uribe. He had offered to mediate, and he was mediating the release of hostages held by the FARC. There was incredible pressure placed on Uribe within Colombia by the military, by the oligarchy, and by the United States not to allow that to go forward, not to kind of showcase Venezuela's role as a mediator. And he broke relationships with Venezuela, and Venezuela was kind of left hanging out there. And that's where all the accusations came from, over exaggerated intelligence reports or falsified intelligence reports about Venezuela's relationship with the FARC, and relations deteriorated. And these are both pragmatic men, Santos and Chavez, in their own way. And I think that they have a lot invested in trying to reestablish good relations. We'll see how long it lasts.
What would you say is the legacy of Uribe, and if you do hold out hope for Santos?
Well, that's the question. Uribe's legacy is basically four things. One is massive civilian deaths, 14,000–15,000 civilians killed during the war. Thousands killed under this false positive, in which practice in which the military would dress up civilians as guerrillas in order to raise the body count in terms of how many guerrillas were killed. They just found a mass grave of 2,000. This massive internal displaced. Colombia has the highest internal displaced population in the world, over 2 million. It's an enormous tragedy. But more important, more structurally, is Uribe presided over what could be understood as the kind of normalization of paramilitary politics, in which paramilitaries weren't so much vanquished as they went legit. They took over local municipal governments. They moved into particularly biofuel production. It's been a massive land grab under Uribe. 10 million acres of land, half of the arable land in Colombia, is now seized paramilitary land. That's not going to change. This is the kind of legacy that Uribe has left to Santos. And Santos, the question is if he's going to continue it or if he's going to try to change it. The big challenge for Santos is that the Uribe model is unraveling. People hold up Uribe as a model, or the Plan Colombia as a model of success for having brought down the FARC, having brought down violence in key urban cities like Bogota and Medellin. Over the last year, year and a half, that's been unraveling. There's more FARC activity. Crime in Medellin has homicide rate in Medellin has skyrocketed, and the hope that, or the attempt to normalize paramilitary politics by bringing them into government on the local level, that's also unraveling. There's factions within paramilitaries. There are what's called mini paramilitaries that are spinning off, that are now fighting with each other over spoils. And Santos, this is the kind of mess that Santos has inherited, where in outside politically it has a reputation as being a success, but internally there's a lot of strains.
Can you talk about the Colombian-Israeli relationship? This is very interesting, because now, well, the former president, Uribe, is one of those heading up the UN investigation of the Israeli commando attack on the Gaza aid flotilla.
Yeah, there's a kind of beautiful symmetry to this. I mean, one would imagine somebody from Likud being put on some truth commission in Colombia. There is this kind of structural similarity between Colombia and Israel in terms of U.S. foreign policy, where the U.S. is the relationship with both countries, and in regions that are increasingly antagonistic or antagonistic, the U.S. is increasingly banking its authority on a highly militarized power that basically makes endless war. Israel in the Middle East, Colombia in the Andes. The U.S. encourages a kind of reckless preemptive doctrine that excuses all sorts of military action in Colombia. It was the raid into Ecuador. Recently, it's been its accusations against Venezuela. The U.S. alone in the Americas has supported and encouraged. I think if you step back and you look at Israel's role in Colombia over the last couple of years, it's been a large supply of aid, large supply of military technology. This is nothing new. Israel in Central America in the 1980s, particularly in Guatemala, was a large, it was an important supplier. Stepping in when Jimmy Carter cut off aid to Guatemala, for instance, Israel stepped in and set up an assault weapons factory in Guatemala, supplied intelligence, technology, and training to Guatemala. It's a long history of Israel supporting some of the worst elements in Latin America.
Final question. President Obama opposed publicly in the last presidential debate before he became president a unilateral agreement between, or the bilateral agreement between U.S. and Colombia, said union trade unionists were being killed in Colombia. We have 10 seconds, yet he now supports it.
He supports it. Hillary Clinton supports it. Ron Kirk supports it. There's a big push by the White House for the free trade agreement with Colombia, and there's a big public relations push by Colombia for a free trade agreement. And I'm sure some of the good language and conciliatory language coming out from Santos is part of this public relations campaign.
Greg Grandin, thanks so much for being with us, author of Empire's Workshop and Fordlandia. Happy birthday to Anjali Kamat. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.